Next case for our argument calendar today is Jericho James. Is it Brody? Is that appropriate pronunciation?
Brody.
Brody?
Yes.
Brody versus the state of Nevada, case number 70311. Ms. Butko, Mr. McCarthy, good to see you both. Are you ready to proceed?
May it please the court, counsel. My client's family is present in court today, just to let you know who's in the corner over there. Carla Butko, on behalf of Mr. Brody, I would like to remain 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
This is an interesting case that proceeded to jury trial. It was extremely hard fought. It was hard fought by both experts, by a long litigation, by pretrial motion work, and by the actual trial itself. At the conclusion of the trial, it became known that there was a juror misconduct question. I think that's probably one of the keys of the reasons we're here today. In that particular issue, juror number 3 did not disclose during voir dire argument that she had been the victim as a young child of child sexual assault. Her comments during voir dire were that she had a big secret and she had seen a doctor. Judge Freeman interpreted that to mean she had a medical issue. Obviously, defense counsel did not interpret that to be she was the victim of prior child sexual assault. By the time she had made those comments about her big secret, two other jurors had already come forward and told the district court that they had been victims in child sexual assault cases. Judge Freeman did an excellent job in asking the jurors over and over again to be open, be honest, tell me everything. He was very clear. John Olson asked direct and pointed questions during voir dire to get to this information, as did the state. And yet this juror chose to remain silent. When asked and when she testified, she said she didn't think it was a big deal. She didn't consider herself a victim. And Judge Freeman found that she failed to disclose a material fact that would have been important to the defense for exercising its preempts, and that was unintentional and not prejudicial. And in this particular case, I would argue to you that if this isn't the most prejudicial failure to reveal information during a jury voir dire on a child sexual assault case, I can't think of one. So the answer is, if this case sets the standard for it's not prejudicial to reveal this kind of information, then there will never be jury voir dire that constitutes misconduct that will gain a remedy in the state of Nevada. So Judge Freeman erred when he decided it wasn't prejudicial. John Olson, the trial attorney, explained that he would have preempted this juror. He had one preempt remaining. He used 7, had one available to take her off the jury panel, and would have done so. So the question becomes one of the charges in the case and that they're so in tune with what this victim suffered. So I would point out that the U.S. Supreme Court in Pena Rodriguez versus Colorado has decided that you can impeach a jury panel on the basis of race only. That case is extremely limited to its facts, and I've read it several times trying to hope I could open big doors with it. But I think it opens a door into the jury room on the question of race. In this particular case, we don't need to open the door because we know this was a 10-hour jury verdict. It was hard fought.
Well, the door about jury deliberation was a little bit opened during the hearing. I read with interest the transcripts between in volume 5, pages 1100 through about 1177. And in there, there is a interesting exchange between Ms. Hicks and Mr. Olson about the vote taken by Ms. Bishop
Pink.
Bishop Pink, okay.
I try to color juror number 3.
Okay, we'll stick with juror number 3. There was an objection by Mr. Olson to the inquiry by Ms. Hicks about how juror 3 voted.
Exactly.
But there doesn't seem to have been a ruling by the trial judge on that.
I agree.
He said simply, we're there, referring to the prejudice question. And then Ms. Hicks was allowed to ask 2 questions, which she did, having to deal primarily with the voting with respect to the acquittals and who led that charge, which appeared to be juror number three. And then later there was a inquiry by Mr. Olson on the same subject. But what becomes of that exchange? You don't appear to be raising that issue in your briefs, so I'm assuming that you're prepared to stand by that record and the objection that was made by Mr. Olson and not ruled upon by the judge.
I think that the
way it's not an issue that is being presented on direct appeal. Is that right?
No, the manner that it's raised is that it's in the prejudice prong.
I'm sorry?
The manner that it's being raised is in the prejudice prong.
Well, I get that, but you're not asking this court to assess the propriety of that exchange. I think that exchange was important to the judge's assessment of prejudice.
And that exchange was improper, and Mr. Olson did object.
But you haven't raised that.
That's correct.
Okay.
But I did raise it in the prong that the judge relied upon information that the defense didn't have a chance to contest.
For purposes of our evaluation of the prejudice prong, the record in front of us includes that exchange between Ms. Hicks and Mr. Olson and juror number three.
And it should
it seems not. Like we should consider that since it hasn't been objected to here.
No, it would
raised.
Seem like you couldn't consider it because it was improperly obtained in violation of all standing law at that point, and that the newest Supreme Court case is dealing with impeaching the jury's verdict by their own testimony on race only. So it basically, the way that I raised it was based that Judge Freeman, when he found no prejudice, did so improperly because he's relying on information he can't have. You would have brought in all of the other jurors and had them testify. Also that this particular juror advised the jury panel that she was a victim of child sexual assault. So she brought extraneous, biased information to her position. So I think we raised it in many veins, not directly in the fact that the judge shouldn't have considered
it. It's hard to say that it was what the influence of that was, or if we should even consider that comment during deliberations. But if we're going to consider the vote, at least on the record, it appears as though this juror was an advocate and voted for, and the verdicts were unanimous for acquittal as well as guilty on two counts. So,
well, we don't know that because we didn't hear from the other 11. We know what this juror said. We also know that this juror said she didn't think it was a big deal that she was a child victim of sexual assault sitting on a child sexual assault case, and that she failed to disclose.
Well, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I've still got a question. Looking at Bowman and determining once there is juror misconduct established, you have to determine the conduct was prejudicial, and prejudice is shown whenever there's a reasonable probability or likelihood that juror misconduct affected the verdict. And again, as Justice Hardesty just mentioned, I'm not sure I see it. Or do we look strictly at the fact that by not disclosing, there wasn't an opportunity to exercise that challenge?
I think that's the key. The key is that juror would never have sat in those shoes. We wouldn't have to wonder what she did say in that jury room because we're not allowed to go into it. And Mr. Olson, I think...
But we are wondering, and that goes back to my question about whether there's a reasonable probability or likelihood that the misconduct affected the verdict.
And I think it did, because as you look at this trial, you have a verdict that goes only with the admissions made by Mr. Broyotti at the police department. He is only convicted on what he said he did. None of the other allegations of this victim caused a conviction to occur. So the reliability and credibility of the victim must have been at stake, because all of the things she said he did, the jury did not convict him of those items. The other things that went wrong is the defense didn't get to bring in their defense experts. They were limited on the types of experts they could call and what the experts could actually go into. The defense offered four jury instructions. None were given. All 49 jury instructions of the states were given in spite of the defense objecting to two. So as we look at the way the trial happened, the motion to suppress is denied. The defense experts aren't allowed to put forth all of their opinions. They're limited. The defense is not allowed to attack the victim with prior statements of prior allegations. The defense's jury instructions are not given. And then we get to a conviction for two counts rather than five. So my view, and I think I'm probably correct, is that we're in some sort of a compromised verdict setting. They're out 10 hours. They're given an Allen charge by the court. 3 hours later, they come back with guilty on two counts. So we had several jury questions. One included, can we just tell our family we're alive? Because it's 10 o'clock at night by now. So we have a jury verdict that's very hot, very hard fought. We have a defense case that's limited. And then we have a state closing argument that just repeatedly says what the defendant said, the defendant said, the defendant said. And the state's argument is convict him on that alone. That is the closing argument of the state, that convict Mr. Briotti for what he said he did. He said he touched her breast. He said he kissed her cheek. He's guilty no matter whether you believe this victim or not. And that was the closing argument. So when we look at the entire record of the case, and we're looking at the prejudice question, we can see the prejudice on this case. This could have easily been a not guilty on all counts, but ended up with a two-life sentence conviction for lewdness based on the admissions of the client at the police statement. And I do want to touch briefly on that before my time runs out here, because Judge Freeman found that that was a voluntary statement. Yet, as you read that statement, you will read Mr. Briotti, an uneducated young man with very little contact with the law. He has one prior marijuana conviction out of California. And you see that he goes to this police station based on false pretenses. He goes there to talk about the fact that his tires are slashed, and he's bringing evidence with him for the cops to investigate. And the cops take his DNA from him based on the fact they're going to check it out against the razor blade and the cigarette butt that's on the scene of the slashed tires. He gets to the police station. He finds out he's not really there about slashed tires. He's there about this molestation claim. Then he sits down with the detective. He's not in custody. Nobody could say he's in custody. He has a discussion with Detective Thielen for about 50 minutes. He says, I got to go. I got to go get my son. He stands up. He walks out of the interview door, and he's in a hallway that is adjacent to the detective division. While he's standing in that hallway, another detective who's been watching this interview approaches and stands, not blocking his exit. But now we have two officers who are armed and one defendant who's uneducated. And we have him standing there 6 minutes with no recordings. Judge Freeman finds it's voluntary that he went back in that room by his own admission and request. And I'm going to talk fast. Then we have, after that incident, we have him say, I got to go, man. I got to go. I got things to do. I got things to get done. Can I go is the critical phrase you'll see in his questions that tells you it's not voluntary that he's sitting there, because he asked the police officers, can I go? With that, I'm going to save a couple minutes here.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Butko. Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court. I'm Kerry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County. On behalf of the state, Justice Perigary and the TV show Big Bang Theory, they called this a virtual presence device. So,
that's right. First, hologram.
I guess we can talk first about the motion for a new trial. It was indeed late, and the legislature has put a time limit on it, and doesn't mean it can't be heard later in some other context, but you can't just ignore the legislature's authority to put time limits on things. The only exception is if one asks for additional time within that first 7 days, and there was no.
Well, don't you also have an exception for newly discovered evidence?
Yes, this is not.
Wouldn't this be considered that?
I don't think so. I'm reasonably certain that the legislature would have meant evidence that is relevant to guilt or innocence, and this wasn't. This is information, but not evidence. If someone had offered this in a trial, offered the viewpoint of a jury as evidence in a trial, it would have been excluded. So it is information.
Well, in context of the defendant having the opportunity to have a fair trial.
Well,
I'm having trouble distinguishing that it's not evidence.
Well, I suppose it's not evidence relevant to the guilt or innocence of the accused. And so it is information. Everything is information. And But the legislature used the term evidence when talking about new evidence, and that has never been applied by this court or any other court that I'm aware of to mean anything other than evidence that is relevant to guilt or innocence of the accused. And so I wouldn't expand it to say new information about jury selection allows for a motion for a new trial within 2 years. There may be another vehicle that's available in which it can be more fully explored, but this was not the vehicle. So the question...
But I mean, again, considering the fact that the judge looked at this failure to disclose as a willful failure to disclose, essentially, and that bothers me.
Well, I understand that, and, you know, I kind of question the proposition that it was a willful failure to disclose in the first place, but it's a finding of fact, and, you know, he who lives by abuse of discretion dies by abuse of discretion, and so it's a finding of fact, and I have to live with it. But I would note that during voir dire, every time someone spoke up, Judge Freeman would assure them, no, the real question is, can you be fair? And after having done that 20 times or so, I don't think we can really fault this juror for not deciding not to answer after seeing all these other people being told the real question is, can you be fair?
Well, it's an interesting point because in the colloquy that occurs in the transcripts that I referenced earlier, Judge Freeman points out the instruction he gives to the jurors about the importance of truthful responses, but then also recites, or there is recited in the transcript, his statement that what you might disclose may be offset by whether you can be fair and impartial. And so it appears as though juror number 3 took him literally at that point. But I think we're dealing with a finding of fact here, Mr. McCarthy, so maybe the time spent would be best used on your view of the prejudice prong.
I agree. The finding of fact is, and I can't really dispute it. So, the first question is, what sort of prejudice is appropriate? Without inquiring into deliberations, the only claim of prejudice is the loss, you know, that the defense didn't get to use the peremptory challenge. In other types of cases, like a improper denial of a challenge for cause and things like that, this court and other courts has held the ultimate question is whether the panel was fair, whether there was an unlawful juror on the panel.
And here's this something we should be examining in habeas? Maybe the counsel who chose not to follow up on the big secret response should be had a strategic reason for not getting rid of juror number 3.
It could be, but habeas is not limited to claims of ineffective assistance, although that is the most common. And the record can be expanded on other claims too, commonly is with Brady claims. And so I suggest that if someday there is going to be a further hearing, either focusing on the decisions of counsel or on something else, that it should be in that vehicle, not in the vehicle of an untimely motion for a new trial. And so the court should rule that there was no error in denying it, one, because it was late, and two, because this is the wrong sort of prejudice. You're looking quizzical, Madam Justice.
That's always my look. But my question is this. I mean, you have the finding of a willful failure to disclose information. That's material. It relates exactly to the type of charges for which the defendant is facing. Then you have disclosure of this outside material to the other jurors in the jury room. How is that just not, starting there, prejudicial? I know the court seizes upon the fact that she voted, we are where we are, that she voted for not guilty in support of the proposition that there's no prejudice. Why doesn't that support prejudice? Why aren't we to presume that juror 3 was designated the subject matter expert on sex assault and that she was able to say, no, these ones are no good, but this one is? I mean, once we get that person in the jury room, isn't there an inference to be drawn both ways?
Well, I think that the sort of prejudice, Not sure I understand, but that which happens after the verdict can't be prejudicial, I think. So the inquiry came after the verdict, and so that couldn't have affected the verdict. So, and the question of whether this juror announced some expertise or influenced the jury and all, I don't know that we should be inquiring about that, but we did. Now, to say we should inquire further now, I don't know. The door having been opened, maybe we ought to shut it. That was the focus of my argument, that the ultimate question is whether the panel, the jury panel, was proper, not whether it affected the verdict. We asked whether it's likely to have affected the verdict, not whether it actually did. And so, in the investigation cases where jurors investigate, we don't inquire into the actual deliberations. We say, is this the sort of stuff that is likely to have affected the verdict? And here, all that we know is that some decades ago, she was sexually abused in some unspecified way by some unspecified person, some unspecified time, and it had some unspecified psychological effect.
And chose willfully, not at least on the findings of the judge, not to disclose that,
right,
which would have been improper. So the question is, based on those facts alone, you're saying if that's all we consider, that would not be sufficient.
I think that is all you should consider, and no, that is not sufficient with the findings of the trial court. Now, I think that kind of, sort of finding that it's not prejudicial, I think this court ought to defer to the district court. The district court has sat through the trial, listened to the witness, talked to the juror, and
well, I was going to ask you about that, Mr. McCarthy. Judge Freeman's explanation on prejudice amounts to about maybe 7 or 8 lines in the transcript on pages 1159 and 60. And essentially, he declares that it's not prejudicial. I don't see any analysis at all. What should the analysis be? I'm not clear as to why this isn't prejudicial. He notes that there's a loss of peremptory, but then declares that it's non-prejudicial.
I think I interpreted that finding as being that's the wrong sort of prejudice. That is, the mere loss of the peremptory challenge doesn't invalidate the verdict, unless the juror was somehow disqualified, that there was an improper juror on the panel. That's how we've done it in other sorts of cases, and that seems to be, that's how I see Judge Freeman's ruling, is this is the wrong sort of prejudice. If all you can claim is the loss of a peremptory challenge, well, you're not entitled to them in the first place anyway. So that has been a proper response in other circumstances, and that's how I perceive this ruling. So it's not
well, and if you look at the Ninth Circuit case in State versus Edmond, it focuses primarily on whether or not a potential juror truthfully answered a question during voir dire, and it was the analysis there was somewhat different, focused primarily on failing to answer a material question. And showing that a correct response would have provided a basis for a challenge for cause. And that's kind of what they're arguing.
Well, there is no such argument. No one has claimed that this juror would have been challengeable for cause, but only that there would have been a peremptory challenge. And in other circumstances, this court has held that's not sufficient. There is no claim now that this juror could have been excused for cause.
Well, the juror denied the opportunity to explore that when the juror willfully decided to omit the information.
Right. But even now, in this appeal, there is no claim that what eventually was learned would have led to a challenge for cause. The only claim is that it would have led to a peremptory challenge, to which no one is entitled anyway. So if that's the ruling of the Ninth Circuit the effect is the loss of a challenge for cause, I'd say that has no application here because no one has made that claim.
Okay.
I'd say that the claim is the loss of a peremptory challenge, and That's the wrong sort of prejudice. And the prejudice about the effect on the deliberations, I don't think we ought to be making that that inquiry, but, you know, the defense
made a motion. Ms. Hicks kind of opened that door, and the judge let her go there.
It is open, and so if we're going to consider it, if it's there, might as well consider it, and that supports the findings of the district court that there was no prejudice. And so you ought to find no error in denying the motion. And whether we look at the right sort of prejudice or the question of the loss of the peremptory challenge, the result is the same. And there was no error in denying the motion.
Is the question on prejudice whether the result would have been the same?
Likely. Whether the result would likely have been the same.
That's my understanding of what the proper standard would be.
Right. But when the claim is the loss of a peremptory challenge, there's a logical disconnect between that and the verdict. So, and that's why this court has not made that jump. And I recommend that you don't make that jump now. So, let's see. Motion to suppress. Well, we've been talking about findings. There's some pretty good findings, and if I'm stuck with them, so is everyone else. The judge had the ability to, he watched the videotape of it and said it was voluntary on many different levels, and that seems to be supported by the videotape. The court noted in particular, at one point the defendant got up, walked out, got to the door, turned around, said, "No, wait, I've got more I wish to tell you." That would seem to support the conclusion that this was indeed a voluntary statement. So there's other factors, but we have to ask somebody to evaluate all those factors. And in this case, we asked the trier of fact who found it to be voluntary. There's a suggestion that the encounter in the hallway amounted to strong arm tactics. And I would point out that is supported by zero. Absolutely nothing. The officer who was there said he made sure not to block the person's way, and it was nothing more than a polite discussion. So there is zero evidence supporting the notion that this was involuntary. Let's see, I'm running out of time. I did have a whole bunch I wanted to say about the subject of corpus delicti, but I'll leave it to this. In 1999, there's a footnote in Dada from this court suggesting that perhaps it's time to do away with it. Well, I'm trying to figure out the source of the corpus delicti rule, and I can't. In fact, I went so far as Blackstone's commentaries where it doesn't appear. It's not found in the state constitution, it's not found in the statutes of this state, and it's not found in the U.S. Constitution. And I like there was a Court of Criminal Appeals of Texas that said this is just simply to give appellate teeth to the standard of review regarding sufficiency. If it has any continuing vitality, it should be limited to that. Thank you.
Well, whether this panel would revisit it or not, even under the rule, the evidence offered by the victim is consistent with the statements made by the defendant.
No matter what else
on the
happens.
Two charges for which guilty was made.
No matter what else happens, there was corroboration. The rest is a nice academic exercise, but shouldn't lead to anything. Thank you for your time.
All right, Mr. McCarthy. Ms. Putko?
Thank you. Here and there, Mr. McCarthy and I disagree wholeheartedly on items. One would be the fact that we have not argued that cause was a factor on getting rid of this juror. At page 34, demonstrated bias in the responses to questions on voir dire may result in a juror being excused for cause. And I cite to the cases that go with that. Page 35, the juror failed to answer perhaps the single most significant question which was repeatedly asked by the court, the state, and defense counsel. Honestly, had it come to the court's attention, the proposed juror was so troubled that she attended therapy as an adult from her molestation as a child, the court would have removed the juror for cause. If not, the defense would have exercised a peremptory challenge, clearly before you on the question of cause. The other things I want to remind you is juror number 3 described this experience as emotional, intense, and uncomfortable.
which tells you that she is still troubled as an adult from what happened to her as a child. And the fact that she saw a therapist as an adult tells you she's still troubled. But she doesn't get off this panel. All she had to do was raise her hand. Two other people in front of her had done that and said, I might not be the right juror for this case. I was a victim of X. One was taken off the panel by Mr. Olson. One was allowed to remain on the panel. But it's a decision you can't make if the evidence and information isn't revealed to you. And the key, I think, even in Pena Rodriguez, the high court goes on and on to tell you how voir dire is the most important aspect of trial work, because you need to get a jury panel that is impartial. And that if the jury panel isn't fleshed out during voir dire, you're not getting a fair panel. And that's exactly what happened in this particular case. The test is whether it's a material fact, it was, being a victim of the same exact crimes that are in front of this jury to decide Mr. Biotti's guilt or innocence. Material. The next question is whether there was, the response would be grounds to challenge, and it would have been. And Mr. Olson could have sought the challenge of this juror for cause for being biased because being a victim of the same type of crime. And as far as looking to what happened after to justify her behavior on the jury, it has to stop at the point where she failed to disclose a material fact willfully. It was prejudicial. Mr. Olson did not go into those areas because he knew it wasn't permitted, and the state did. I think it's a slippery slope if we start allowing the state to bring in the jury people, ask them about what they ruled, and then the defense takes the high road and doesn't do the same thing. We could have brought in 11 others. We might have heard some interesting talks. We don't want to go there. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Butko, do the panel members have any additional questions for her?
No, thank you, Chief.
All right, Ms. Butko, Mr. McCarthy, we always appreciate your excellent briefs and advocacy in these cases, and this case will stand submitted.